Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program, she lost an MP to the Liberals, but now she's hit back with an accusation of a very personal and possibly racial attack. Look at this.
They will essentially stop at almost nothing in order to secure this majority, even if it means suppressing the views of their newest member, even if it means going after the first Black and Jewish woman to be elected to this this role, even if it means creating divisions about a very sensitive issue, which is people's views on the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Green Party leader Anna Meepal accuses the federal government or the Liberal Party of targeting her after MP Jenica Atwin, Green MP, crossed the floor and joined the Liberals. Now, Ms. Paul's Green leadership could be in question. We ask Anna Meepal to join us to talk more about this. She declined, but the leader of the Green Party of Quebec, Alex Terrell, will be here in a moment. Remember, the Quebec wing of the party has questioned her leadership and possibly wants a review. We'll find out why. And a last-minute overhauling of the Language Officials Languages Act, but why now?
With this bill, our goal is to bring the Official Languages Act into the 21st century.
Federal government proposes controversial changes to the Official Languages Act, among them beefing up protection of the French language in Quebec. But with only days left before the House rises for the summer, is this bill actually more of an election promise? The woman you just saw, Mr. Melanie Joly, will dig in to that. And Tom Mulcair will weigh in on that as well. Plus, more funding to search residential institution sites. But is it enough?
Our government will work in collaboration with Indigenous leaders to ensure the process is Indigenous-led.
The Ontario government adds $10 million for the search for children who never returned home from residential institutions. But is there enough money and enough political will to search every site in Canada? We'll ask the Assembly of First Nations Ontario Regional Chief Roseanne Archibald. Lots on the program today. It's Power Play. Let's get to the players. We begin tonight with the Green Party, and the Green Party is starting to redline. There are calls for leader Anna Meepal, who's not even been in the job for a year, to have her leadership questioned. She's rejected calls for her resignation today, but she's clearly fighting to maintain power. There's already a debate among some senior Green Party leaders about a possible no confidence motion. This all comes after the former Green MP, Jenica Atwin, crossed the floor last week to join the governing Liberals. Atwin blamed Anna Meepal's inadequate response, her words, to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis as the main motive. Now, she initially stuck to her claim, though, that Israel was an apartheid state. She had said that in a tweet, end apartheid. Yesterday, though, she retracted that statement because it doesn't align with the Liberals' official policy. Well, today, Anna Meepal took aim at the Liberals for poaching Atwin, saying it was actually in a personal attempt to destroy her leadership. Check this out.
They are cynical, that they are aggressive in pursuit of their majority in the next election, that they are willing to sow division, that they are willing to encourage people to turn against their beliefs, that they will essentially stop at almost nothing in order to secure this majority.
So it's an interesting allegation. Floor crossing is a very old tradition, as you all know. Atwin was one of only three Green MPs in the House. Anna Meepal, as you know, failed to win a seat in the Toronto by-election. Now, what happens now to the Green Party leader? Could she bounce back and withstand this crisis? There are calls for her for a review of her leadership. Now, Alex Tyrrell is the head of the Green Party of Quebec, and they have questioned the leadership of Anna Meepal, and Alex Tyrrell joins us now. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to start, first of all, with this remarkable allegation that the Liberals' poaching of Jenica Atwin was personal. Anna Meepal said that they are doing anything to pursue a majority, including targeting the first Jewish and Black leader of a federal party, sort of bringing religion and race into this. What's your view on that?
I'm really sorry that Anna Meepal feels that way. I think that anybody who is running to be Prime Minister of Canada has to be ready to take a certain amount of criticism. They have to be ready for things to happen, like MPs to defect and that sort of thing. So to blame this on the Liberals when In reality, this crisis was provoked by Annamie Paul and her inaction with respect to her spokesperson, who went around making very slanderous claims about the members of Parliament for the Green Party, vowing to defeat them in the next election, really gave Jenica very few choices. And I think that she was left with either going forward to the election with a party that has a lot of internal problems, with the leader's spokesperson vowing to work against her, or to quit politics, or to take an offer that was made to her by the Liberal Party. So she made her decision. I fully understand it. I think it calls into question Annamie Paul's leadership. And there's a lot of very serious conversations happening in the Green Party of Canada about that at this very moment.
Tell me what serious conversations. Would you like a leadership review? She rejected the idea of resigning right now. What's your view of Annamie Paul? What needs to happen right now?
I think that the best thing at this stage is for Annamie Paul to step back from the leadership of the Green Party of Canada. I think it would be the best thing for the party itself. There's people who are advocating for a leadership review. It's a process that would take several months. The membership would have to be consulted. We really have no time to waste. The federal election is coming up very soon. The party has very few candidates named. We need to really tackle this issue as quickly as possible. And I think that, I really support Annamie Paul's leadership once she won the vote. But unfortunately, there hasn't really been much of a unification process since that happened. There's a lot of people that are feeling
I'm just trying to figure this out. I understand that her former senior advisor had accused some of the three MPs of being either anti-Semitic or discriminatory. And I understand there was a real unhappiness of how she handled that. But she's been in the job not even close to a year yet. Why not give her a chance to run in a federal election? Why, when you say step back, you mean basically resign right now?
Yes, unfortunately, it's really a sad day to have come to that, and it's not something that I take lightly. But if you look at what's happening now, the party has lost one-third of its caucus. And it's not just that Jenica made this decision. It's also that Annamie did not take steps to prevent it from happening. A week before Jenica's decision was announced, Annamie's spokesperson was saying, well, if we lose Paul Manley and Jenica Atwin over this, well, so be it. That's unacceptable. You can't go against, Jenica and Paul Manley represent the only substantial gains that the Green Party of Canada has made over the last 10 years since Elizabeth May was elected, to just, treat it with complete disrespect and disregard for all of the work that went into getting those people elected, to take no responsibility for it, and then to continue attacking the media, the other parties, for the situation that was created within the Green Party of Canada itself.
So you don't think, you think when she said that she's the first Black and first Jewish woman to head a federal party, and she said she's being attacked, that the Liberals are attacking her, and that's a factor. You think what? That she's wrong?
Look, I can't put myself in her shoes, and I'm sure that it's not a very easy thing to be the first Black and first Jewish woman leading a federal party. So I can't really speak to her experiences, but I think that anybody who's running to be the prime minister of the country, whether it's Jagmeet Singh, who's also a person of color, or Annamie Paul, everybody has to play the political game. These things happen. I don't think that that the Liberal Party is going after Annamie Paul because she is Jewish or because she is Black.
Okay.
I think that it's normal that you have a political debate.
So she says she's not going to resign. In your view, has Annamie Paul lost the authority, in your view, to lead the Green Party?
I think so, yes. And I've been speaking with really hundreds of people from all across the country. I had hosted a town hall meeting last week. There was over 100 people that attended. The overwhelming consensus was that, Annamie's refusal to correct the situation, to make statements to defend her members of parliament, and then her handling of the fallout from Jenica's decision makes it really difficult for people to go forward. How can we support somebody whose spokesperson is saying they want to defeat the caucus of the party?
I mean, and what did you make of the fact that Elizabeth May, the former leader, has not come out and formally endorsed Annamie Paul, which she did 6 months ago or 8 months ago?
Right. Well, I mean, I think Elizabeth had said to the media that she was considering calling for Annamie's resignation. Of course, a very big decision for anybody who's involved in a leadership role to call for such a thing. So we'll have to see what happens. Some people have suggested that Elizabeth May could come back as an interim leader. Personally, I'm somebody who's been somewhat critical of Elizabeth, especially in the later years of her leadership. But, you know, we're really in a difficult situation here. The election's coming up very quickly. The party needs to be prepared. We have to have our candidates in place. It's a huge challenge. We're really in a difficult situation right now.
Okay, so just, Alex, before I let you go, I just want to be clear here, because you said the word step back, so I just want to be clear. Are you calling for Annamie Paul to resign?
Yes, I'm calling for her to step back and resign the leadership of the Green Party of Canada.
Effective immediately. All right. Okay. So we'll see where this battle goes. Listen, I really appreciate this. Obviously, she's refused to do so. We did ask Annamie Paul to come on today to respond. She declined to come on. Mr. Tyrrell, thank you, sir. And I know we'll be speaking again. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay, we will pick up that. Tom Mulcair is going to join us on the press gallery later. But you see, there's lots of political ramifications of that and political ramifications for the Liberal Party. Tough accusation from Annamie Paul there. And then the Liberal Party has not exactly been unified when Jenica Atwin came in and joined them with her views on Israel and the Palestinian crisis, not aligned with the official Liberal view either. Meantime, today there was an ambitious rehaul of Canada's Official Languages Act, something the Liberals have long promised to do. They say the overhaul will protect French language by codifying the right to work in French in federally regulated businesses, to speak French and get translation in every legislature, in court, in Quebec and in Manitoba, and give enhanced powers for the Official Languages Commissioner. It will also affirm that French is the official language of Quebec and that New Brunswick is officially bilingual. What's the catch in all this? Well, it's timing. With only days left before the House rises for the summer, why table a critical and complex bill this morning? Is this more political than substantive? Let's find out. Joining me now is the official languages minister, Melanie Joly. Minister, good to have you here. Just days left before the House rises for the summer. This has been promised for years. There's no way to get it done before the House rises. Why wasn't a bill this comprehensive tabled earlier?
Well, this should not be a surprise, Evan, because we said it in throne speech that we would be doing it. Then I tabled a policy document, which was a substantive reform document in February. And we just tabled a bill today, which I hope will have the support from the opposition in the House. All parties have said in the past election that they would make sure to modernize the Official Languages Act. Now we have said, what does that mean? And therefore, we're tabling this important legislation that has not been really modernized in a generation.
I get that, but you know, it's not going to, the House is going to rise. We all knew you were going to table it. There's a very good chance there's going to be an election in the fall, in which case this dies on the table. It's got to be retabled. You know that there's a lot of folks that are already saying this is a bit cynical to do this just days before. Even the Bloc Québécois suggesting that if there's an election and the Liberals win a majority, you won't never retable this. So I'll just ask you again, you've had years to do this. Why just do it right now?
Because we've worked on it and now all the stakeholders agree with the fact that we had to reinforce the protections within the Official Languages Act. And at the same time, it's not as if it's the first time that the Bloc Québécois is just trying to scare people across the country. Now, what we want to do is to make sure that we move ahead. This will continue the legislative process. We have to use every single day that is allowed to us in the House of Commons to continue the government's agenda. Maybe, we don't know, right, but maybe the Official Language Committee will continue to sit this summer. Therefore, the work will continue. And should there be elections, Evan, what will happen is if we are a majority government, we will table the legislation again.
You will. Okay. Again, I'll just ask you, your party has been in power over the last decades many times. Your particular government has been in power for 6 years. Why now only recognize French as the official language of Quebec? Again, is that because of what the Quebec provincial government has done to try to change the constitution to do that? Is that a response?
Well, the Quebec government is saying that they have sole jurisdiction over language. We fundamentally disagree. We think that we have a jurisdiction over languages, particularly in line with everything that is federally regulated, so within our jurisdiction, and also that we have a constitutional responsibility, I would say constitutional duty, to protect official languages minorities, which are Francophones outside Quebec and English-speaking Quebecers. And so that's what we're doing today. We're asserting our jurisdiction. We're making sure that we are doing our homework within our own responsibility, within our own jurisdiction. And that is why it was so important to table this bill.
Okay, just out of interest, do you believe, as the minister, that Quebec has the right to unilaterally change the constitution to say that French is the official language of Quebec in the constitution?
Well, and I've just answered that. We think that we have jurisdiction over language. And therefore, if Quebec wants to change its part of the constitution in line with its own internal affairs, the Constitution provides for that to be done. But that can't go against, for example, Section 133 of the Constitution that says that in courts and legislative assemblies of Quebec and Manitoba, both official languages must be used. Or again, the other, the Section 23 of the Charter, Evan, that says that school boards in Quebec are protected. English school boards, meaning. So that's why we need to make sure that we protect our constitutional rights of our minorities.
Well, let's talk about that, because English minorities in Quebec are worried about how this could impact their careers. How will they be protected?
Different ways. First and foremost, we will continue to support organizations that are key to the English-speaking community. We will also make sure that we support the key institutions that are vital to their community. That's the first time that the federal government recognizes that obligation on its part. And also, we know that the Core Challenges Program, which is really the funding that supports minorities when they go defend themselves before courts on constitutional matters, we know that that program is extremely important for Anglophones in Quebec. And so that's why, for the first time, it will be protected in the Official Languages Act.
Okay, just real quick, I have two last questions about this. The role of the Official Languages Commissioner is enhanced. So if there is an institution that does not comply, what are the consequences?
They'll have to comply. And if they don't comply, well, then the Official Languages Commissioner can go before the federal tribunal to make that happen. And so the Official Languages Act.
What's the consequence? I'm just trying to figure out what's the consequence. If, you know, let's say another premier says, notwithstanding what these laws say, they'll use the notwithstanding clause that Quebec has threatened to use and Ontario just used, and they say, sorry, we're not going to have French in there. What is the punishment?
So it applies, the Official Languages Commissioner's power apply to the government, the federal government, and it applies also to federally regulated companies in Quebec and in regions with strong Francophone presence. It doesn't apply to provinces. It doesn't apply to basically things that are outside federal jurisdiction. That is then before the courts, and that's just would be, proceedings under constitutional matters. So for the Official Languages Commissioner, what is possible now is, let's say somebody is not able to work in French and that person is Francophone in the public service, well, then he can make sure that that violation ceases, and therefore he can continue, that person can continue to work within the federal government in its own official language, so in French.
Okay, and would this mean that I'm reading through this bill, which, by the way, is a little complicated. Any justice on the Supreme Court would have to be bilingual in French and English. Is that right? You'd have to be before you're selected. You know, there is concern that that would alienate a lot of potential jurists, even Indigenous jurists. You're saying that a prerequisite now to be a Supreme Court justice is to be bilingual?
It has been our policy since 2015. We've been appointing Supreme Court justices at the Supreme Court that are bilingual, one from Newfoundland and Labrador, another from Alberta, another one from Quebec. So we know that it is important to uphold bilingualism at the Supreme Court. But at the same time, we need to make sure that we always further reconciliation. Our institutions must reflect the communities they serve. And what we're doing right now is we're really appointing many Indigenous judges across the board in many superior courts. We've appointed more than 15 of them, and we really hope that in the coming years we'll be able to appoint a Supreme Court justice that is Indigenous and also that is bilingual, because when you are sitting on a superior court, you have access to free French languages, such as MPs, for example, and therefore you can have access to both official languages.
Boy, that was a big issue when Malcolm Rowe was appointed, as you say, in 2015. Just last thing very quickly, and this is slightly off, but it's important for your party. Your party just accepted Jenica Atwin. She crossed the floor from the Green Party, as you know. Her views on Israel, an apartheid state, according to her, obviously very much at odds with the Liberal Party, very much on pipelines as well. I know she's retracted some of those. But today, the Green Party leader, Annamie Paul, said that your party, I'm going to quote her, she said, your party will stop at nothing in order to secure a majority, including going after the first Black and Jewish leader elected to this role. Can you respond to her allegation that your party is attacking her and that race and religion are a factor?
Well, I'm sorry that Mrs. Paul is feeling that way. That's certainly not something that we are definitely aiming for. And we respect her religion. We respect her her ethnic background. We respect her as a leader. And I, as a woman, I was extremely happy to see that there was a strong federal party leader in charge of the Green Party. Now, Mrs. Atwin's decision to join the Liberal Party is based on the fact that she believes that it's the best way for her to represent her Fredericton community. And we're very happy to have her part of the team as the Minister of Economic Development, working on issues relating to supporting businesses in Atlantic Canada. It will be a pleasure to support her. And also, she has a very strong Francophone community. So, again, we will continue to defend the rights of Acadians in Fredericton and in New Brunswick.
All right, I got to leave it there. Minister Jolie, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Okay, so that's Melanie Jolie on a bunch of different issues. Coming up, though, the man who used to head up Canada's vaccine rollout is fighting for his career. Major General Danny Fulton's legal counsel filed an application for a judicial review examining why he was removed from his post on the rollout without being reassigned elsewhere. We'll talk to one of the Major General's lawyers next. Stay with us. A familiar face at the weekly federal COVID-19 briefings is challenging his removal. Major General Danny Fulton's legal counsel filed a notice of application with the federal court yesterday. He's seeking a judicial review of the decision to remove him from his post as head of logistics for Canada's vaccine rollout and not being reassigned. Remember, Major General Fulton was ousted from his role on May 14th amidst an investigation. CTV then reported that the investigation was into a sexual misconduct allegation dating back to his time as a student at the Royal Military College. Major General Fulton denies any wrongdoing. But we now have one of his lawyers, Natalia Rodriguez, a partner at Conway Baxter Wilson, and she joins us now. Thanks for joining us. The court application cites, and I'll quote, political interference in the military chain of command for the decision to remove Major General Fulton and not reassign him. What are the allegations of, quote, political interference?
Absolutely. Thanks, Evan. So the allegation there goes to the fact that under the military chain of command, any decisions relating to the reassignment or the removal of military duty of an officer needs to come from the chief of defense staff. And in this case, there was an acting chief of defense staff. And so that decision had to come from that individual. Instead, the information we have and the evidence we have is that the decision was actually made by the ministers of national defense, the Minister of Health, and the Prime Minister of Canada in consultation with the clerk of the Privy Council. So that is an improper interference into the military chain of command. And, you know, there are reasons why we have a separation between the military and political actors. And in this case, that division was not respected.
This is interesting. I have asked both the defense minister and I've asked the health minister personally if they interfered in this and why they didn't call if they knew there was an investigation for his removal earlier. And they both said that would be political interference. In other words, they have openly and publicly denied that they had anything to do with his removal and certainly not with his reassignment. They said that lay squarely with the military. Are you saying that that Major General Fulton and you have evidence that they are not being truthful when they say that they recuse themselves from any or they had nothing to do with that decision?
The evidence we have is that they were involved because that's exactly what Major General Fortin was told by the acting chief of defense staff, that it was out of his hands and that the decision had been made at the ministerial level. Now, that's the evidence we have, and that's the evidence that we'll be presenting in court.
That his testimony that the acting chief of the defense staff told him. Remember, at that moment, Major General Fulton was dual-hatted. Though he reports to the chief of the defense staff, in this case, the acting chief of the defense staff, he was seconded to public health. He was reporting to Ian Stewart, who runs Public Health Agency of Canada, who reports actually to the Minister of Public Health, in which case, under that chain of command, would it still be improper for the Minister of Health to say, now that you're seconded here, I don't want you seconded anymore during an investigation and pending the outcome, we'll see what happens. What's wrong with that?
Well, in this case, actually, we have our evidence is that Mr. Stewart also was not involved in the decision or was not able to prevent the decision ultimately, and that he, along with the acting chief of defense staff, indicated that it was being done at a higher level. Now, with respect to the fact that he is at Public Health, the Public Health Agency of Canada, yes, he was seconded, but he is ultimately a military officer, and that's where his position ultimately lies. He is not an employee of Health Canada. He is not a civil servant. He is an officer of the Canadian Armed Forces, and he continues to be during a secondment.
Is there any evidence that he and you will present that the Prime Minister was also either aware of or acted in his removal?
Well, certainly the evidence we have and what Major General Fortin was told was that the Prime Minister's office was involved and that they had decided that the political calculus had changed and that in conjunction with the ministers, their decision was that he had to be removed at that time. So that is the evidence that we have.
Okay, interesting. Finally, this legal challenge is separate from the criminal investigation taking place in Quebec because there is an investigation into that. If you're successful in getting this legal challenge granted, does that impact the criminal investigation into Major General Fortin that's taking place in Quebec?
These are totally different processes. There should not be any effect on that. That's an independent process that I'm not involved in, so I can't comment on. Our legal challenge is really with respect to the decision to remove him and not reassign him. And that's the decision that we'll be asking the federal court to quash.
Okay. And I just have a couple seconds. So is the Major General alleging that the acting chief of the defense staff would not have either A, removed him, or B, if so, would have reassigned him? But his desire to take either of those options was quashed by the center?
I'm sorry, it was quashed by the...
This said like the Prime Minister's office, the ministers
yes.
and the Prime Minister's office?
Well, we certainly can't speculate on what the acting chief would have done. All we know is that he ultimately did not make the decision and he should have been the decision maker. And that is improper political interference by the ministers in this case.
All right. I got to leave it there. So this is very interesting. Natalia Rodriguez representing Major General Danny Fulton on this. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Okay, so we're going to watch that. We'll talk about that in a little later in the show as well. But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, I should say, is on his way back to Canada after meeting with top European leaders in Brussels this morning. They agreed to work together to end the pandemic with the goal of getting everyone around the world vaccinated as quickly as possible. Mr. Trudeau also toured the Pfizer facility before his departure. That one has produced millions of the vaccines. Many of those shipped right here to Canada, probably some of them in your arm right now. CTV's Glenn McGregor has more from Belgium. Glenn.
On the last day of his trip to Europe, Justin Trudeau toured the Pfizer facility behind me. This is where 12 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been made that were sent to Canada. And Trudeau thanked some of the workers he met while he was touring the facility, looking at the place where they package the vials of vaccine into boxes for shipping, 6,000 doses in one little pizza box, they call them, and they pack those with dry ice. Now, Trudeau also today met with European leaders to talk about vaccination, among other things, including the possibility of waiving patents on vaccines like the Pfizer vaccine made here in order to get more supply into the developing world. Poor nations have called on the World Trade Organization to consider waiving patents on COVID vaccine. And it was discussed also at the G7 meeting in Cornwall, England, over the last weekend. But there's a lot of opposition from some of the countries that make a lot of pharmaceutical products. They are very leery about messing with intellectual property on drugs because it's such a lucrative industry and lucrative to their economies. Britain and Germany both particularly opposed. So nothing really came out of that. Trudeau today was asked about this, said it was a complicated issue. He also didn't have a position really when asked about Europe's move towards what is something close to a vaccination passport. They call them digital COVID certificates. You get it on your phone. It shows that you have proof of immunity either through vaccination or from recovering from it. Now, Trudeau is flying back to Ottawa, and he's going to have to deal with some of his own country's travel rules when he gets there. He's going to have to check into a hotel at the Ottawa airport and quarantine at least overnight while he waits the results of his COVID test that he takes upon arrival, and then we'll have to spend the rest of that 14-day quarantine period at home. Glenn McGregor, CTV News, PERS, Belgium.
All right, thanks for that, Glenn. All right, stay with us. The legacy of Canada's residential institutes continues to cast its shadow across the country. The Ontario government has announced $10 million to search residential institute sites across the province for more unmarked graves. Is this enough for the families and survivors trying to heal? We'll talk to the Ontario Regional Chief, Roseanne Archibald, next. Stay with us. The shadow of the awful discovery of the remains of 215 Indigenous children at unmarked graves in Kamloops, BC, is still lingering over the country. Today, the Ontario government announced it was providing $10 million to support the search for unmarked burial sites at former residential institutes in that province. Remember, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission identified 12 sites in the province of Ontario that need to be investigated, but there are likely more. Ontario's Indigenous Affairs Minister Greg Rickford told CTV News Toronto that at least 426 Indigenous children are known to have died at the schools in that province, while an unknown number are still missing, an unknown number. So is $10 million enough to provide closure or to actually get some identification of what happened at those residential institutions? Let's find out. Joining me now is the Assembly of First Nations Ontario Regional Chief, Roseanne Archibald. I should say she's also running to be the National Chief to replace National Chief Perry Bellegarde on July 7th, so that's coming up. Great to have you on the program, Chief Archibald. I want to talk about the Ontario government giving $10 million to help with the identification and the investigation, obviously, into the unmarked graves at residential institutions, I don't like the word school, in Ontario. There were 18 of those residential institutions in that province. The last one closed in 91. In your view, should all of these institutions and the grounds be investigated with radar to find unmarked graves?
Absolutely. We need closure for First Nations and also for Canada. When the 215 children were found in Kamloops, it really was an awakening moment for non-Indigenous people and for our allies across Canada. And we all need to know. And certainly we need a healing path forward. We need closure and identifying any of these mass sites, grave unmarked sites is really important as we move forward.
And you would believe that in the province of Ontario, there are unmarked graves like the ones found in Kamloops at the Institute there.
Absolutely. They're everywhere. We know of people who survivors have talked about, many of the students who never went home. They talked about, you know, some really horrific things happening in these residential schools, like babies being incinerated, like really, really awful, horrible crimes against humanity, crimes against children. And we need answers. That's what this process is about, is to find out how many additional children went missing and are buried in these unmarked mass graves.
What kind, I just hope, if you just permit me for 10 seconds before we just go on to the next question, just hearing that you believe that and that it's likely the case, we just got to pause that there's more unmarked grave of children who were supposed to be sent to a school. It's hard just to move on to something else that is the situation that we're in. So I'm just trying to give a little honor to that moment for a minute. What kind of investigation needs to happen? You're talking about everything, radar, identification, getting the records, everything.
Everything. We have to, when they do discover, because we know they will discover more graves, we need forensics to be involved. We need to know how these children died and why they were buried in mass graves. Why weren't they sent home? Why weren't autopsies done? There are a lot of unanswered questions around children who went missing while at residential school and their families were never told that they had died.
Is there enough money here? The federal government says we'll give money. They finally released money that was supposed to be allocated in 2019. Now Ontario is giving $10 million for that province. Do the provinces need to top up because the federal government money was not enough or too slow? What's your view on this?
Well, the federal government announced $27 million, and Ontario just announced $10 million, which is almost a third of what has been offered nationally. And to me, that speaks to the issue of the federal government needing to invest more into this process. This process we have to get light on what has happened in residential schools across Canada. And the federal government is a key player in that process, and they have to invest the proper amount of resources.
How much is that?
Well, if Ontario alone is offering $10 million, then, you know, you look at that across all of Canada. How many residential schools were in each province? You know, you're looking at perhaps $100 million or more that's needed.
Finally, in Ontario, what are the records like? Have the church and have the governments given the communities access to all the records they need?
No. We need access to records. Records have been destroyed. How are we going to build the information around how to deal with these deaths when some of the records have already been destroyed by the church and by the federal government? So we need to figure out how we're going to access records from the church, particularly. The Vatican has a very large archive. And we need access to that archive when it comes to the Catholic Church. But there are other denominations who also have archives. We need that information in order to conduct proper investigations into the deaths of all these young children.
All right. So there's more money needed, more records needed, more investigations needed. There's a lot here. Assembly of First Nations Regional Chief for Ontario, Roseanne Archibald. Thank you, Regional Chief. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Evan. Take care.
Okay, we're going to take you to Saskatchewan now. Premier Scott Moe is announcing further loosening of restrictions in that province. Check this out.
That are getting vaccinated each and every day, our numbers do continue to fall. And we can keep moving forward with our reopening roadmap as we had planned. This Sunday, we will move to step two of that reopening. In step two, capacity limits on retail and personal services, table capacity limits in restaurants will be removed. Event facilities such as theaters, casinos, museums, and recreational facilities will be able to increase their capacity to 150 people. And private indoor gatherings included in that are household gatherings. They can now increase to 15 people. while public indoor gatherings and private outdoor gatherings will be able to increase to 150 people, significant increase over where we have been. We are now very close to also reaching the benchmark for step three, our step three reopening threshold. We're actually less than 1% away from that threshold. Just need 1% more of Saskatchewan people to reach out and get their first shot for us to reach that target. If that happens by the Sunday, of course, and step three would start on July the 11th. And when step three starts, most COVID restrictions are then removed. And when 70% of all eligible residents over the age of 12 receive their first shot, then we will be able to activate.
Okay, so that's Saskatchewan moving in to another phase as case counts across the country are going down, which is a great thing, and the reopening begins. But let's return to the story that we started the program with, the leader of the Green Party, Annamie Paul. She is clearly in the hot seat as her party grapples with the loss of Green MP Jenica Atwin, who, well, literally saw red and bolted. She became a Liberal. Now Annamie Paul is rejecting calls to resign. She may be facing a leadership review. Her party is actually going to decide tonight whether or not to kickstart that review. Annamie Paul has been the leader of the federal Green Party for less than a year. She made history as the first Black and Jewish woman elected as the leader of a party. But today she said that she's being targeted by the Liberals, and that was a factor. She even mentioned the fact, I'm the first Black and first Jewish leader, and they're targeting me because of that, or at least partly. So what does this mean? The Globe and Mail's Bob Fyfe joins us. He's the bureau chief here in Ottawa. Le Devoir and the Gazette's Emily Nicolas on the press gallery. And our special guest is political analyst and former NDP leader Tom Mulcair. Man, there's so much to talk about. Okay, let's go quick through this. Tom, first of all, Annamie Paul's in deep jeopardy. Today she said that as the first Black and Jewish leader, the Liberals are targeting her. That's why she lost an MP. I just spoke to the leader of the Green Party of Quebec, who literally is calling for her resignation. What do you make of this?
Well, I wouldn't take much notice of the head of the Green Party in Quebec. It's never really done anything here. Annamie Paul is in danger simply because Jenica Atwin turned her back on her own voters and took the offer that was being made to her. Instead of saying that she wasn't eligible to ever come to the Liberals because she talked of Israel apartheid, Dominic Leblanc rolled out the red carpet for her. And it's astonishing. Here in Montreal, very large, well-structured Jewish community, people are up in arms. They can't believe that someone who talks about Israel apartheid would be getting that. She also specifically went out of her way to attack Annamie Paul. And, you know, you can just imagine, she is the only Jewish leader of a party. Saying she's too soft on Israel plays into an old trope about divided loyalties, without even mentioning the fact that because she is the only Black leader, saying that she did nothing in the face of what Atwin had decided was apartheid played to another very uncomfortable, below-the-belt blow. So I don't think that the Green Party can survive if they go after the leader right now. I know, because I know how she plays the game, that, of course, Elizabeth May is just waiting in the wings. Some of the people who have been making this decision are very close to her. I think it would be an incredible mistake. That party has a lot to offer. It's got great policies, and Annamie Paul, frankly, is a breath of fresh air on the Canadian political landscape. But I'm not sure she's going to survive.
Emily Nicolaggi, what your view on this, and does Elizabeth May step in?
I'm not sure about Elizabeth May. What I do know is that there's an internal crisis within the party where there is very different positions that has been impressed on Israel and Palestine. At the same time, when a crisis like that happens, when there's division inside a party, that happens all the time. What makes it more threatening to a leader is when there are additional burdens. And yes, being a woman, being a Black woman, is something that makes leadership very difficult. You're going to be judged two times, three times harder for the same mistake. That's not something that I'm making up. That's something that's been documented very well already. And so the Green Party was already, very much criticized in the last election for being actually one of the parties, if not the party that had the least diversity in its slate of candidate last time. If it's doing this time, it's really not looking good for them. And frankly, the Liberals are very, very, very happy about what's going on, because one thing that they might not be happy about is division of the vote. So if there's an internal crisis, good for them. If they manufactured it, good for them also in a very cynical way.
Bob, your read on, I don't know, what's happening to the Greens You know, Elizabeth May's role? Is it a poison chalice for the Liberals? Where are you standing on all this?
Look, the Liberals and New Democrats can't be happier about this. The Green Party has totally screwed themselves. We have a situation here now where the leader of the Green Party is dead in the water. And we are about to have an election in late August. And the party's tearing themselves apart about an issue largely dealing with Israel and the Palestinian issue, which most Canadians don't care about. And they are simply dead in the water here. Here you had a black woman, a Jewish woman, who I agree was a breath of fresh air, and she's an enormously intelligent person. But the party is not going to allow her that opportunity to present herself to voters. The Liberals are going to take some of that vote. The NDP are going to take some of the vote. And the Green Party is dead. And even though I'm sure that Elizabeth May is going to try to jump in here, but it won't make any difference. The party is dead now for the next election campaign.
Wow. And I wonder if she survives. Okay, I wonder if we have time here. Tom Mulcair, I had Melanie Joly, the official languages minister. She's tabling this update to the Official Languages Act. Days to go before the House rises. Pure politics or substance? Tom Mulcair.
It's both. It's really clever politics, and the actual bill, I've had a chance to read the whole thing, is very well crafted. It pleases a lot of the Francophones outside Quebec. It provides rights to both consumers and workers that have been asked for a long time. The English-speaking community of Quebec is going to be less worried about this bill than it is about Mr. Trudeau's supporting Bill 96, which purports to change the Canadian Constitution unilaterally. That remains the biggest problem because that removes rights from the English-speaking community. This one should go through and will get a lot of support even amongst the Anglos.
Okay, I got 2 minutes. Emily Nicola and then Bob Fyfe. Emily.
The bill is timed in a way that if it does go through, good for the Liberals. If it does not go through, it's a point to platform on, so it's also good for the Liberals. So whatever happens, it's good for them. In terms of the actual content of it, I also think that it removes some weapons in an electoral campaign for the Bloc Québécois. If the Liberals were not moving on language, the Bloc could have used that against them, and there is very much a two-way street battle happening right now in Quebec. So strategically, the bill makes sense.
Yeah, I agree on excellent points. Bob?
I'm not going to disagree with what anybody, the other people have said. So.
Yeah, there's a political angle. It's not going to, I mean, obviously the House is going to rise, but they will campaign on this, and if it passes, it passes. Bob, okay, I think I have time for this. Bob, because you broke the story about Lieutenant General Rouleau going golfing with the former CDS, Jonathan Vance, who's subject to allegations that he denies, who the heck is going to carry the bag for all this disarray in the Canadian military? Bob.
Well, unfortunately, nobody seems to want to step up to the plate and carry the baggage on this. It should be the Minister of Defense. He should be resigning as a result of this, but that's not going to happen. I mean, what has happened here, we've watched over the last many months, is the leadership in the Canadian military is an absolute joke. And the people who are there should be gone. And it sends a terrible message to all the women who have been sexually harassed, who have been raped, and the leadership don't get it. They think it's okay to go golfing with a guy under a police investigation, the former chief of defense staff. It's all madness.
Yeah, Bob Fyfe, Emily Nicola, and Tom Mulcair, great to have you on. I got to leave it there. Bob didn't mince words. We'll see you in 23 short hours. Thanks for watching.